Welcome to Food for Thought Podcast. Today's episode is In the Heat of the Moment, Coping with Anger and Anxiety in Trying Times. Before we begin, my name is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. You can find me at joyfulvegan.com and on social media. Thank you so much for subscribing to Food for Thought wherever you listen to podcasts, and thank you for sharing it with others, for leaving ratings and reviews, and for supporting it. Food for Thought is a 100% listener-supported podcast, so you can join other listeners in supporting this podcast and receiving podcast transcripts as well as other bonuses and perks by going to patreon.com/Colleen Patrick Goudreau. Thank you so much in advance. And it's been wonderful to connect with so many of you in my online cooking classes I've been hosting each week. The classes are interactive, they're fun, and they're live in real time from wherever you live in the world. I've got a multi-camera setup so you can watch me talk and answer your questions, and you can see the food at the same time with me in split screen. You get the recipes in advance, so you can even cook along with me, and you get a recording at the end of each class. I have been trying to make a system so that I can offer the videos to those who can't make the classes, and I'm sorry it's slow going. But I hope you can join us. I pick a different theme each week, and we've got some really fun themes coming up. We've got Italian, we've got French, we've got Middle Eastern, we've got another pizza class, we've got outdoor barbecue type summer food. We'll just keep going. So please go to joyfulvegan.com/classes to register. If you are a Patreon supporter, you receive 10% off of any class you join. So please check your email, your Patreon account for your discount codes. Hello, everyone. I hope you are doing fabulously well. Of course, the cats just came down to join me while I record, so you may hear them in the background. As regular followers of my work have heard me say, hopefully ad nauseum at this point, I hope you're sick of hearing this because it means that it's in your bones. One of the biggest misconceptions about being vegan is that it's an end in itself. For me, being vegan is a means to an end, not the end itself. The end, in my view, is to live as compassionately, consciously, and healthfully as possible, and not supporting the industries that are characterized by the opposite of those ideals is the most significant, the most obvious way to do that. Compassion is the goal. Veganism is a way to get there. So all that's to say, being the best vegan I can be has never been my goal. Being the best human I can be has always been my goal. Several years ago on this podcast, I introduced my 10 stages of what happens when you stop eating animals, and they've since made their way into a book called The Joyful Vegan, How to Stay Vegan in a World That Wants You to Eat Meat, Dairy, and Eggs. And thank you to those of you who have read the book. The 10 stages I identified are framed around the process of becoming awake to animal suffering, as well as to the negative effects on our health and on the earth of consuming and producing animal products. But because the foundation and core message of my work has always been living consciously and compassionately, with veganism as one of the ways to do that, as the way to do that that is so meaningful. It's an easy way to do it, to wake up every morning and to manifest your values in your daily behavior. It's pretty amazing. But I could easily repackage the same content into a series or a book called The Joyful Human, How to Stay Joyful, Conscious, and Compassionate in a Challenging World. And so for those of you hearing about this for the first time, these stages, which are not linear and not mandatory and which follow awareness, cover such topics as bearing witness, compassion fatigue, self-care, and the voracious consumption of information, guilt, regret, remorse, finding peace and choosing self-forgiveness, explaining your newfound awareness to friends and family and to yourself, evangelism, fundamentalism, knowing the difference between enthusiasm and zealotry. Anger is one of the things we talk about. Hint, hint. Finding and embracing your identity, building community, feeling a sense of belonging, finding your voice, communicating with people with whom you disagree and with people with whom you agree, stretching your comfort zones, finding your place, advocacy and activism, and adapting and acclimating to living in this crazy world. These experiences are not unique to being vegan. They're unique to being human. And I hope you check out the book wherever you are on your human journey. Of course, the cats are like running around right at this moment. And moaning and poning. When I first came out with these stages, I heard from so many of you who identified so much with stage 5, with anger. And that's what I want to talk about today. Now, I've never liked dating my podcast. I don't want someone to stumble upon an episode from 5, 10, 14 years ago, and someday maybe 100 years ago, and not listen because they think the content within is no longer relevant. The content is always relevant, of course, once you get past any announcements I may have in the beginning. Sorry, but that's the way it is. And I do try to remove some of those as time goes on. But there is no way I can or want to avoid talking about what's happening in our country, in our world right now, and the anger, anxiety, and trauma so many of us are experiencing. I did commit to producing a series on how COVID-19 is affecting animals. So, I mean, I'm clearly not so rigid about not having things in the podcast that are time, you know, relevant, and I will continue doing that. But I want to talk about what we're experiencing right now, how to cope with anger, with anxiety and trauma, whether they're triggered by a deadly pandemic, social unrest, injustice, violence, or suffering, will always be needed and always be relevant, because there will always be social unrest and injustice and violence and suffering in this world. And frankly, there will also be more deadly zoonotic pandemics to contend with, at least until we make some serious changes to the way we interact with animals and the natural world. We are all around the world dealing with major trauma. In fact, several major traumas at the same time. Any one of them on their own would be enough to tax us. But with all of them happening at once, we are literally in a cauldron. First of all, we're dealing with a worldwide deadly pandemic virus that, as of this writing, which will be dated as soon as I speak, has infected almost 11 million people and killed 525,000 people worldwide. In the United States, my home country, COVID-19 has claimed the lives of 131,120 Americans. It's 131,000 Americans. And just to give you perspective, World War I claimed the lives of 516 Americans. COVID has now topped that. The response to the pandemic in the United States and in some other countries and places has been atrocious, and we're suffering for it. We're suffering for it mentally, physically, emotionally, as a country, as a people, socially, spiritually. We are suffering for the pandemic and our response to it. Add to the virus itself and the loss of loved ones, once we knew what we were dealing with, we were told to shelter in place, which, while life-saving if we did it right, has also created its own set of problems we can't deny. For some, it's just the challenge of being separated from friends and family. We are social creatures through and through, and if this pandemic and lockdown doesn't demonstrate that, I don't know what would. For some, it's not being able to be with loved ones as they were dying or once they died, even if they didn't die from COVID-19. For some, it's not being able to participate in normal rites of passage and rituals that help us cope with stress and grief, or that enable us to celebrate joy and transitions. I can tell you from experience that losing my mother during this time has made the grieving process messy and chaotic and difficult and prolonged. It turns out that death rites and mourning rituals exist for a reason, and without them, you feel unanchored. But my little story is just one of millions, and how many others have experienced the same or didn't have high school or graduation from college or milestone birthday celebrations or anniversaries or any and all of the holidays and rites of passage and occasions that we're used to celebrating in a particular way but can't and probably won't for a very long time. For some, it's being unable to or afraid to go to medical facilities to address unrelated health issues such as heart disease and cancer treatment, surgery, or just breaks, bumps, and bruises. For some who live alone, they're experiencing depression and isolation, including seniors in nursing homes or in care facilities, or even just at home, who haven't been able to get visitors for fear of infecting them with the virus. For some, they're living with the fear of going out of the house or touching anything they come in contact with. lest they contract the virus. We know more today than we knew in the beginning, but it's estimated that more than half the people who test positive for COVID have no idea how they got it. And many of those people were vigilant about following recommendations from public health officials. That's not reason to throw up our hands, but it is reason to be vigilant. The point is, we have anxiety around contracting something that could very well kill us. And if we do survive it, could leave us with debilitating effects. So that is very real for so many of us. And that leads to immense amounts of stress. For some, it's having children and having to adjust to them being out of school, figuring out homeschooling or virtual schooling, and then in the summer, figuring out activities for them when school is over and parents have to work. For some, it's been the reality of being locked in with abusers, which is horrific in itself. For some, there's been loss of work, not being able to get to work, not having medical insurance once they no longer work, or having a job that puts you at risk, like healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, shopkeepers, police officers, EMTs, firefighters, just the list goes on of people who are continuing to work in careers and jobs that put them at risk for contracting COVID. And then, of course, just every stress in between, where to shop, how to order online, how to find toilet paper, which, thank goodness, has rectified itself. But how everything about our lives is just different. Remembering to bring a mask before you leave the house, being worried you'll get too close to someone if you're at the store, having to go back home if you forget your mask, wearing gloves while shopping, not being able to linger at farmers markets or just see people or just be among our community members, not being able to see our neighbors, not being able to hug our friends, not being able to travel, not, as I said, being able to celebrate milestones. Remember that 50th birthday celebration I mentioned in a previous episode, where a number of friends and I were going to go to Jack London State Park for my birthday for a catered lunch and then a special surprise I had planned afterwards. Yeah, that didn't happen. The pandemic happened instead. Now, honestly, I'm alive. I am well. My husband and my friends are well, and I'm grateful for that, period, full stop. But, and yeah, we were supposed to be on another CPG trip that we had to postpone. We were supposed to be in France and then hiking in the Dolomites in Italy for my 50th. Best laid plans and all that. And so, of course, I'm fine, but it's disappointing. And the point is, we're all disappointed. Everything is different. Our lives have been turned upside down. So in addition to the virus, a deadly virus that's killing people, and the lockdown, both of those things are difficult enough. Then came the economic consequences of shutting down businesses and the economy in order to save lives and not overtax hospitals and healthcare workers. Loss of jobs, loss of income, loss of savings, loss of housing has led to extreme anxiety and insecurity for so many people. According to the American Psychological Association, money is the top cause of stress in the United States, even before the economic shock from the pandemic. And this has just made everything worse. Consumer spending supports like 70% of the U.S. economy, and it's crashing in community after community as people avoid stores, restaurants, movie theaters, offices, and other public places. Of course, some industries have been hit harder than others: travel, hospitality, restaurants, hotels, and already vulnerable communities and populations, including communities of color, are also typically hardest hit by recessions and job losses. And this is just the beginning. The ultimate economic fallout from the pandemic is yet to be determined. The pandemic right now in the United States is getting worse because we lost control of it. We lost control of ourselves. And a vaccine is most likely years away. There may be a vaccine to lessen the severity of the virus and prevent so many deaths, but one that will make us immune to it, not likely for some time, which means this is just a new reality for us. For a very long time, there will forever be a pre-COVID and an after-COVID world. And that alone is enough to create anxiety. We are literally grieving the lives we once knew. In addition to the pandemic itself, the social isolation, sheltering in place, the economic shockwaves, and the fear of the future, we are finally confronting, in this country, unresolved centuries-long racial tensions, systemic racism, and political divisions. As I wrote in a recent blog post at joyfulvegan.com, this was now a couple months ago I wrote this, the United States has been in a tinderbox for decades, and the last few years have especially been very difficult. It's been a slow, steady daily burn of anxiety and anger and pain. I mentioned earlier that American deaths from COVID have now topped the number of Americans killed in World War I. Another bit of comparative data, COVID-19 has now killed more Americans than every war since the start of the Korean War combined. Wars usually unite us against a common enemy, but not so here. We have made enemies of each other. While the real enemy grows and spreads and survives and thrives, it's the only job it has, and it thrives on our chaos. COVID-19 is apolitical, atheist, and apathetic, and it thrives on our chaos, disorder, and tribalism, and so it is. COVID-19 is the enemy, not each other, but we have turned to scapegoating and finger pointing, not unlike other pandemics in the past. If you just look at the history of other pandemics, we've scapegoated other groups and we've finger pointed and blamed. It's not new, unfortunately, for humans. We conspiracy theorize. That's also not new. And we've chosen divisiveness and denial. We've demonstrated lack of unity, lack of empathy, and lack of compassion. Not everyone, but some of us. So job loss, fear, insecurity, isolation, debt, disparity, disease, and death, and then George Floyd. It was what finally broke us, and it should have. And so here we are today, and so the story unfolds. Protests, demonstrations, a collective call for change, and a resistance to that change. There is a lot of stress, a lot of heat, a lot of division, but there's a lot of camaraderie. And despite everything I just named, I am hopeful. As terrible and tragic it is that yet another Black man was killed by a police officer, I believe it is precisely our shared shock and sadness and outrage over his death that has the potential to put us back together again. Clearly, we are not indifferent. Clearly, we are not complacent. Clearly, we are not apathetic. It's precisely because our vision, our expectation, our hope for a just and compassionate world has been thwarted that our anger was fueled. If we didn't believe such a world was possible, we'd be indifferent. But we're not indifferent. We're motivated, we're moved, and we're angry. And that shows our lack of apathy, which is a good thing, but we need to talk about anger. The way each of us copes with the awareness of suffering, injustice, and violence against humans and non-humans is diverse and varied. And while it's true that anger can be motivating, it can be cathartic, and of course it can be justified, it's also true, as I discuss in The Joyful Vegan in Stage 5 and beyond, that sustained anger can have dire consequences, that anger is a choice, that anger is not necessarily a prerequisite for change, that anger is a superficial, socially accepted response to something much deeper, and that you don't have to be perpetually angry to demonstrate you care. So let's talk about anger. Why anger? What do people get out of anger? One thing people get out of anger is a feeling of control, especially when we feel out of control. And all of the things we've been talking about, job loss, fear, insecurity, isolation, uncertainty, debt, disparity, disease, death, they all make us feel out of control. What's more, we can't ignore the fact that animal suffering, and specifically the fact that our confinement of and consumption of and encroachment upon animals and their habitats is exactly what leads to pathogen spillover, and in this case, what led to zoonotic coronavirus, one that jumped from non-humans to humans, is of course anger provoking. It's incredibly difficult to know that this is what happened. It could have been prevented. We know this is what happens again and again. We keep seeing this repeated again and again. And so, of course, it's just infuriating. to know, especially those of us who are not part of that system, we're still victims of it. Of course, the animals are victims of it, but we are now suffering from this, you know, global pandemic, and we're not contributing to that industry. And so that's, you know, that's really frustrating, and we feel powerless to stop it. So people are angry when they feel powerless. People become angry when they feel powerless because anger makes us feel like we're not powerless. Anger makes us feel like we have power, like we have control. So anger in response to all of these things is justified and understandable. But in all the years I've been listening to people's experiences, as well as tapping into my own, I have come to believe that anger is on the surface and something much deeper is underneath. Something else is at the core. And in fact, this is reflected somewhat in the etymology of the word anger. And some of you have heard me say these things already in the past. The earliest meaning of the word anger referred to something painfully constricted, a strangling, a pain, a narrowing, a squeezing, a throttling. And our modern word anger comes from an Old Norse word meaning anguish. In other words, while we may experience anger on the surface, on the outset, something much more tender and vulnerable is underneath. And that something is pain. It's anguish. It's sorrow. Anger, however, is just easier to manifest. It's familiar, it's recognizable, and it's culturally supported. Anger has gravitas, right? Sorrow and sadness are interpreted as weak and ineffectual. Some people, especially men in our culture, may even feel ashamed to show sadness at all, since vulnerability implies frailty in our culture that values masculine traits. And I hear from both men and women who tell me that when it comes to animal issues, they don't know how to talk about them without crying or without just demonstrating sadness. They don't know how to talk about animal issues and animal suffering without feeling weighed down by the sadness, as if showing such emotions would negate or undermine the seriousness of their message and beliefs. And so they either say nothing at all, or they display the more socially acceptable emotion of anger, which ironically can have really negative effects on their message and on the relationships and on themselves. We don't see a lot of people who have really negative effects from just, you know, I mean, especially social effects from sadness, but there are a lot of really negative social effects and even interpersonal effects and personal effects from anger. Anger is natural. It's not something to be ignored or suppressed, so please don't mistake what I'm saying for that. But depending on its frequency, duration, and intensity, anger can be detrimental to our emotional, mental, and physical health. The stress hormones triggered by anger contribute to the fight or flight response that protects us from danger. A constant flood of these chemicals and their associated metabolic changes can also strain our systems, our central nervous systems, our digestive systems, our immune systems, and our cardiovascular systems. Anger causes an elevated heart rate, increased blood pressure, and high glucose levels, which can lead to stroke or heart attack. And another side effect of anger, decreased blood flow, that can lead to digestive issues, headaches, migraines, and insomnia. Even experts say a short burst of anger can impair the immune system for several hours after, and if sustained, can lead to an increased risk of infection. Chronic anger, as we already know, I mean, we just know this anecdotally, you don't have to read studies. Chronic anger and rage are linked to unhappiness, low self-esteem, self-harm, drug and alcohol addiction, depression, poor peer relationships, and a greater likelihood of abusing others mentally or physically. Now, knowing all of that, knowing those are the effects of anger, which we do have control over, self-compassion and self-preservation should be reason enough to be wary of chronic anger. But unfortunately, I think we all let ourselves go to it too quickly for some of the reasons that I already named. And I've seen many advocates cling to it as fuel. A popular axiom circulating in many social justice-oriented circles, not just among animal advocates, not just among vegans, says that if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. Moral indignation becomes a measure of how much we care. If we're not cynical about the past and pessimistic about the future and angry about the present, then we're apathetic, we're delusional, or we're willfully ignoring injustice and violence. The world then becomes a zero-sum game of offenders and defenders, victims and warriors, sinners and saints. Operating within this framework, it's no surprise then that well-intentioned advocates tell themselves that to let go of anger or to see that other people who aren't as angry and outraged as they are, right, that implies that they're choosing inertia and inaction. So looking at it through that lens, letting go of anger becomes tantamount to betraying the victims of injustice who desperately need our intervention. The anger that would be a means for change becomes the end in itself, and being angry becomes a point of pride, a mark of identity characterized by disgust and misanthropy. What may have been someone's primary motivating force for change, and anger can be that, both their own personal change as well as the change they want to bring about in the world, becomes the destination. And as a result, many become addicted to outrage and mistake it for activism. The problems with this model are manifold. Not only does sustained anger not feel good and not treat us very well, as I've already indicated, it's also not effective or productive in the long run. It tends to manifest itself as self-righteousness, martyrdom, indignation, and judgment, all of which corrupt intelligent discourse and turn people off or make them defensive, especially people who may already be in agreement with you on the issues, but who don't react well to being attacked. Not only is prolonged outrage ruinous on one state of being, it's just not sustainable. Our outrage may be justified, and indignation may make us feel virtuous, but neither changes hearts, minds, or even laws in the long run. Outrage doesn't change the world. Vision and vigilance do, along with the political, technological, economic, and moral forces that drive progress forward. And so fortunately, it's not a zero-sum game. We can be passionate and powerful and productive without being misanthropic or self-destructive. We can be acutely aware and actively engaged and politically minded and happier and more effective as a result. We can decide at any given moment who we want to be and how we want to act. The choice is ours. Choosing to lead rather than react, choosing to inspire rather than agitate, choosing to guide rather than goad are just a few examples of subtle ways we can direct our passion without losing our purpose. Paraphrasing what I say in The Joyful Vegan to be more broadly considered, someone who's joyful and hopeful while working to enact change has no less determination to end violence, suffering, and injustice than someone who is perpetually angry and reactive, right? So you can be both. You can be joyful and hopeful. You can be all these things, joyful, hopeful, and work to enact change because violence and suffering and injustice are not okay, right? So there's this meme that you have to be like perpetually angry and reactive in order to, I don't even know what, maybe just show that you care. I feel like that's some of what happens for sure. So that's just a false dichotomy. But someone who is joyful and hopeful while working to enact change is more willing to find resolution than she is eager to be right. She's more interested in solving the problem than she is determined to claim the moral high ground. And I think that happens a bit as well. Now, I am not suggesting that you try to deny anger if that's what you feel, but I am cautioning against allowing yourself to inhabit chronic anger and treating anger as an end rather than a means. And also allowing anger to control you. I mean, so, you know, if the idea is to be in control and feel in control and have power, then I would argue that anger actually winds up controlling us. And that's kind of the opposite of what we want, right? So how do you do this? How do you live your life in such a way and go through everything we're going through and witness what we're witnessing and want to have a different world and want to, you know, see justice and compassion and nonviolence and all the things we care about? How do you go from being angry to being a joyful, hopeful, active, and productive human? Or at least, how do you move in that direction? How do you orient yourself to that? Number one, embrace the underlying sadness. I think the first step is embracing and expressing the sadness and the sorrow that underpin the anger you may be feeling. As I mentioned above, I hear from many people who want to talk to others about animal issues, but when they do, they just break down and cry. Now, that might be the same for someone who wants to talk about racial injustice or environmental destruction or human rights abuses and so on. And so out of the desire to be stalwart ambassadors, they suppress their feelings and their tears and they show their anger instead. And they wind up hindering their emotional, mental, and physical well-being in the process. And also, I think it hinders the interaction we have with people. So my advice, be sad. Yes, even when you're talking to others, even if you feel the need to cry, just like cry. Now, I know like there are appropriate and inappropriate times to just, you know, cry. And I'm not suggesting we just break down sobbing and wailing. Like, you know, every time we talk to someone about difficult and emotional, issues. But I am suggesting that we not be afraid if our voice shakes and our eyes well up. Exhibiting emotion when talking about emotional issues is not only healing, like our bodies produce a morphine-like painkiller when we cry. So it's not only healing, it may very well make us better spokespeople for the things we care about, for animals, for compassion, for justice, for nonviolence. Evolutionary biologists found that tears may actually make interpersonal relationships stronger. Crying, says, I quote, Oren Hassan, he's an evolutionary biologist from Tel Aviv University, I quote him in my book, he says that tears can elicit mercy from an antagonistic enemy and enhance attachments and friendships. And his findings suggest that tears can inspire sympathy and even strategic assistance, which is why sadness is more effective than anger when talking to people about the issues we care about. I don't think we should have the expectation that people will respond more sympathetically, but there is no doubt that they will respond more positively and less reactively to vulnerability than to a wall of anger. So number one is embrace that underlying sadness. Tap into that. When you feel anger welling up at this point, tap into exactly the sorrow that you're feeling and let yourself just go more tender and vulnerable. It's an interesting experience, and I think it's something we fight. I think it's something we resist because of everything I've already said. Number two, be discerning when bearing witness. The next step in transcending anger is related to something I discuss in the first stage of the 10 stages regarding bearing witness. We have to be honest with ourselves about how much suffering we can endure. Now, that might mean avoiding or at least being discerning about looking at images, watching documentaries, reading stories that depict violence against animals or anyone. It might mean going on a media blackout, not looking at the news every day, getting off social media for a bit, or at least limiting your exposure. Decide to spend 15 minutes a day on social media, to share something, to catch up on the news of a friend, and then stop. Spending hours scrolling through feeds and headlines and videos and people who are acting poorly and behaving badly, it is just enough to raise your blood pressure for like the rest of the day. And it leaves you feeling completely powerless and depressed and disempowered. You feel disempowered. You you can't do anything about everything you're consuming and everything you're taking in. And that goes for other types of media as well, TV, radio, newspapers. It's very passive. It's very passive. It's not active to just scroll through your feed and take in what someone else is feeding you. You're literally there with your mouth open and someone's just shoveling into your mouth what they want you to consume, right? Decide yourself what you want to take in, right? Be discerning about what you want to take in. Now, obviously, read, be informed, learn, bear witness, but be discerning about what you take in. Talk about this when it comes to what we eat. Be discerning about what we put into our body. Why is that any different about what we feed our minds with? Bearing witness is absolutely necessary. And I devote an entire chapter to it in The Joyful Vegan. But we have to be prepared for it as well. Especially now that we are already so vulnerable. We're already so fragile. And there's so much going on. We make ourselves powerless when we turn away from reality. Only when we have all the information and are informed citizens do we have the power to do something. If we don't look, not only do we shirk our own responsibility, we also abdicate our power and deny the best of ourselves. But it doesn't mean we have to do it all the time. Just because we look doesn't mean we have to stare. Now, some people, some vegans feel that they're letting the animals down if they don't perpetually dwell on how bad it is for them, if they don't take on the same suffering as the animals. That's not advocacy. That's martyrdom. And it's not effective. It's self-indulgent and potentially self-destructive. The risks of immersing ourselves in cruelty and violence are very high, potentially leading to depression, chronic anger, empathic distress, and even apathy. Self-preservation isn't selfish. It's imperative. Animals don't need us to be as distressed as they are. You have heard me say this before. They need us to transcend our distress so that we can successfully end theirs. And this applies to whatever type of advocacy you're involved in. Just expand it. People, animals, the earth, they don't need us to be as distressed and stressed as they are. They need us to transcend our distress and stress so that we can successfully end theirs. Use the power you have. Don't sink into the despair. That's not helpful. So be discerning when bearing witness and be prepared. In the bearing witness chapter of The Joyful Vegan, I talk about preparing yourself when you're about to bear witness by just checking in with yourself first, making sure you're emotionally equipped to deal with looking at disturbing images or reading difficult accounts of violence. Like if you're already in a vulnerable place, if you're already feeling really just vulnerable, if you're just having a bad day, it might not be the best time to go look at more, right? We just have to make sure we have the wherewithal to be able to cope after bearing witness. Otherwise, it drains us rather than motivates us. That's not helpful. That's not sustainable. It's not effective. We have to be discerning when bearing witness, and we have to be prepared and strong when we do so, so that once we're done, we can just get on with things, right? And that's something I also talk about as well, creating a plan once you do bear witness. Like just being enraged is not the point. The idea of bearing witness is that it motivates you to act, not just emote. So this seems like a good place to stop and just give a shout out to all of you, to thank you for your support, especially to Brooke Bussard, Michal Stone, David Cabrera, Alexander Gray. Thank you so much for your support. I was interviewed by someone recently about the work that I do and, you know, the business that I run, essentially. And, you know, I said, like, I wouldn't be able to do this if it weren't for my supporters. And, you know, even if it's $5 that you're supporting or 10 or 50, 20, all of it adds up and it enables me to do this. So your $10, your $50 a month, your $100, and some of you are giving more than that, it all adds up and enables me to spend the hours and hours that I have already spent, for instance, on this episode to be able to share with you what I hope is valuable. So thank you to everyone who supports this podcast. Thank you to my generous supporters, Jennifer Watkins, Jennifer Statmiller, Max Goodman, Mike, Nina Bircher, PJ Schuster, Ranjini Mohan, and Tina Strassheim, and everybody at every level. Thank you so much. We have some new supporters, Lauren Oller, Kristen Bailey DeMello, Olivia Jabe, Holly Armstrong, Kristen Pisano, Grace Hyde, Carol Gibson. Thank you so much. And remember, supporters at $10 a month and above receive written transcripts to every Food for Thought episode. And at $20 a month and above, you get an audio recording of a love and kindness meditation, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. It's another suggestion I mentioned in The Joyful Vegan for Coping with Anger, and I'm going to talk about it a little bit at the end here. And all supporters get 10% off of the online cooking classes, and perks are being added all the time. So if you're getting anything out of this podcast, my work in general, please consider becoming a supporter. You can just go to patreon.com/ColleenPatrickGaudreau, or if it's easier to remember, just go to joyfulvegan.com and you can click on the donate button. Thank you so much. You give me hope, which is my third prescription for transforming anger. Choose hope. I could not do this work. I could not call myself a joyful vegan or a joyful human, and I do, if I did not have hope, or rather if I did not choose to dwell in hope and know my hope is not delusional and know it's not naive. It's rooted in facts. It's rooted in science. It's rooted in reason and statistics. I have hope because there is much to be hopeful about. History gives you great perspective if you step back. My hope is not complacent. It's provisional. I don't just sit back and wish things would change and wish everybody would see things the way I saw things. I take action to facilitate that change because I believe change can happen, because I see that change does happen. I dwell on what I can solve rather than on what I can't, including how other people behave, how other people think, what other people say. I don't have control over that. There are plenty of reasons to be angry at the injustices in the world. There always will be. But there are plenty of reasons to be hopeful because of progress in the world. We decide which one we want to focus on, and I choose the latter. I have hope because I choose to. Like anger, hope is also cultivated. You have to work to keep it alive. And when it comes to all of the issues we care about, all of the injustices we're fighting to overturn, we have come so far. We have so much work to do, which is why I said that hope doesn't mean complacency, but we absolutely have to trust that the work we do to create the world we want will manifest in change. If we didn't believe that, why would we do anything in the first place? We are hopeful. You're hopeful. You are hopeful. That's why we act. If you don't believe anything will change, then you would just sit back and rest on your laurels and not do anything and complain. And that's called cynicism. But that's not what we do. We recognize what's wrong, what needs to be done, and we work to make change happen. Our hope is exactly what drives us. So own it, choose hope, and get active. My fourth suggestion for coping with anger and anxiety. There are a lot of problems in this world, which means there are a lot of ways to get involved, to be part of the solution to the problems you identify and feel passionately about. If anger makes you feel you're in control, it's a false feeling, or at least it's a fleeting one. A much better way to feel you're in control is to act. Be part of the solution. You will feel so empowered when you're in solution mode rather than just reactive mode or in the mode of complaining about the problem. And keep in mind that while using social media to identify causes and organizations you want to get involved in and like-minded people to connect with, just posting on social media, not a solution. Just like anger, social media should be a tool, the means to the end, not the end in itself. In terms of how you can get involved, as I always say, do what you love, do what you're passionate about, do what you're good at, do what you feel needs doing. And remember, advocacy is not algebra. There is not one single answer to the problems of violence and cruelty and animal exploitation and animal consumption. There is not one single answer to the problems of injustice, human rights abuses, and violence. Although I do think some forms of advocacy are more effective than others, and I'm personally comfortable with some and not comfortable with others myself personally in terms of what I'm going to do, no single type of advocacy works best. Because no single type works independent of the others. Individual forms of advocacy do not exist in a vacuum. Every one of them works off of each other. We need advocates who do everything. We need people who do everything. We need advocates when it comes to veganism and animal issues. We need advocates who create recipes, write books, make films, teach cooking classes, provide accurate nutrition information, and demystify plant-based eating, cooking, living, and shopping. We also need innovators who create new products, investors who infuse money into those products, and lobbyists and trade groups who can ensure these products are equitably represented in the marketplace. We need advocates who raise awareness, write letters, screen documentaries, rescue animals, and run shelters and sanctuaries. We need advocates who help enact and enforce laws, change policies, educate, litigate, and legislate. We need advocates who change hearts and minds, and those who change institutions such as schools, restaurants, corporations, and governments. We need it all. And so, whatever you choose to do, do it well. And know that you're making a difference. And I thank you. Whatever you choose not to do, get out of the way and let others do the work they've chosen. I've seen so many advocates fall into the trap that they know exactly what works and that everyone else is wrong and everyone else should be doing exactly what they're doing because otherwise everyone else is wrong. Be wary. My warning to you is to be wary of any advocate who says that their single form of activism is the right way and that everyone else is hurting rather than helping. It's one thing to come together to discuss, you know, efficacy and strategy and improvements if that need be the case. But it's quite another to devote precious time and to spend limited social capital publicly criticizing, condemning, and undermining other advocates, whether they're individuals and organizations. And we are seeing that happen every day. There are a lot of problems in this world, my friends, and there are a lot of people who sit on their duffs doing absolutely nothing to solve them. There are fewer people who actually get up, speak out, and do something to make this world a better place. Anyone, even if you disagree with what they're doing, anyone who dedicates their time, their resources, and their money to help animals or people or whatever it is, whatever the causes are, they're not the problem. Apathy is the problem. In other words, worry less about people who don't agree with you. Harness instead the energy and power of the people who do agree with you. Get to work, do your work, and let others do theirs. Now, I am probably preaching to the choir because I think all of you listening are already of that mind, but perhaps it will enable you to feel secure and stable when you are criticized. I am on the receiving end all the time. There are people who think I should be doing something different than what I do. And of course, on social media, it's really easy to finger point and it's really easy to just tell you that you're doing everything wrong and that you should be doing it this way. So I'm saying this to you, you will get that pushback, you will get criticism, you will get people who tell you you're wrong. So my point is, I hope that gives you your own strength to not question. I mean, certainly it's okay to question things. Are you doing the right thing? Are you being effective? Are, you know, I talk about this in The Joyful Vegan in the chapter on advocacy. Of course, we should always be examining what we're doing, but that doesn't mean you should question that you're doing something that's meaningful to you because someone else says it's not. So I hope that gives you your own, hope it gives you some strength and inspiration. Number five, have perspective. I've already spent a great deal of time in this podcast and in my work in general over the years talking about how to remain detached from the effects of the work you do. But I will just repeat a bit of that here. This is a marathon, not a sprint. Buckle yourself in for the long haul. The need to speak up for what you believe in, for what is right, for what needs to change in this world will never end. Just knowing that will will sustain you so that you don't ride this roller coaster of emotions. Once you accept this is an imperfect world, you relax into the ride. As I say in The Joyful Vegan, this is earth. It will never be heaven. There will always be cruelty, always be violence, always be destruction. As Rebecca Solnit says from her gem of a book, Hope in the Dark, we cannot eliminate all devastation for all time, but we can reduce it, outlaw it, undermine its sources and foundations. These are victories. A better world, yes. A perfect world, never. And her book, Hope in the Dark, I highly recommend it to all of you. It celebrates activism as a journey rather than as a means for achieving utopia. And similarly, in his book, you've heard me talk about Enlightenment Now, cognitive psychologist Steven Pinker makes the case that in every way progress can be measured. Health, prosperity, safety, peace, knowledge, happiness, crime, disparity, just name it. Things are better now than they used to be, even though there is much work to do, as I said before. It's not about being complacent. It's about celebrating the victories that we have and then get back on. Pinker, like Solnit, reminds us that although we will never have a perfect world, that doesn't mean we should stop trying to make it better. Holding that perspective will help you manage anger and anxiety and enable you to create space for levity, laughter, and buoyancy, which is my sixth remedy. Laugh and relax. A sixth way to transform anger and anxiety into joy is through laughter. Now, I kind of just said that I really do tend to consume books and films of a darker nature. But when my husband and I sit down after a long day, we laugh throughout the day, but we always make a point to watch some of our favorite comedy sketches or just something funny. Humor is incredibly healing, and it is a mandatory prescription for transcending anger. Scientifically proven to benefit our mental and physical health. I don't need to tell you this. Laughter just relieves tension. It boosts energy. It increases resilience, something we all need. It releases endorphins. It reduces stress. It reinforces social connections. It strengthens the immune system. It counteracts feelings of anxiety and anger and sadness. And simply and unsurprisingly, it reduces anger. It reduces anger and increases joy. So find your favorite sources of laughter or people, whoever your favorite sources of laughter are, and luxuriate in it. And it's not just laughter I'm talking about here. It's just providing some space to just relax, to just let go. Every great piece of music has pauses to counterbalance the notes. If you just played notes, it would just be noise. You need space. You need air. You need pauses in between the notes. So create some of that for yourself as you're speaking up in the world and doing what you feel is right. And number seven, my seventh suggestion for dealing with anger while still remaining engaged is to connect with others. Being part of a community is vital for us as social creatures. As I said in the beginning, if we did not realize how connected we are to each other, this definitely taught us that, this lockdown and this pandemic. We need to be connected to one another. Now, having like-minded people in our life does help us feel less alone and part of a united front, but we also need to feel accepted and loved within that community, right? Being connected also means feeling that you're part of your larger society. How can you transform something you disengage from? Being connected means resisting the us versus them mentality. So I realize it's difficult right now to connect with people the way we're used to connecting with people. That's one of the things causing trauma right now. But there are many creative ways to connect with folks. Yes, a lot of them are online, but that doesn't mean social media. There's just a lot of meaningful ways we can connect. So again, I realize that you've probably been doing some of this, but you know, Zoom happy hours are a thing and they've been amazing. I went to a Zoom wedding. I attended a Zoom wedding and it was incredible. It was absolutely beautiful. So keep doing those get-togethers. Keep doing those happy hours. I've done, you know, trivia. Do, you know, find things. Get together with friends. Have a drink. Have a happy hour. We normally have a 4th of July we'll parade on our street with our neighbors. It's pretty cute. We're not doing it this year. So I, you know, created a Zoom event for us to have a little hour long, you know, happy 4th of July with our neighbors. It is so important to find these ways to connect with each other, especially when we're ripped apart from each other. And especially when, like, as I said, all of the rites and rituals have been thwarted. Take an online class, take an online course. Yes, you can take my Joyful Vegan Cooking classes. They're super fun, but it's a great way to meet others or to meet with others, right? Some people who've joined my classes have actually met on the online classes. Can I tell you how cool that is? And some come together, some join together, even though they live in different towns, so that they can connect on the classes. But there are so many classes and courses to take, both audio and video. There's a million podcasts to listen to. But I'm talking about finding ways to connect with each other through these kinds of courses. I've talked about the great courses on Canopy. There are master classes online. There are libraries with tons of downloadable courses that are free. Take an online class with a friend who doesn't live near you, or who does live near you, but you're not seeing right now, and have regular phone calls to discuss the week's material. So do these courses together. So connect with people you love, connect with people you care about, but, you know, find creative ways to do that. Pick up the phone and talk to a friend. Get off the computer. That is not computer related. You don't have to just be on the computer to connect with people. Sit down and write a letter. Connecting with people doesn't mean technology necessarily. Write some letters, write some cards to friends. I've been doing more thank you letters than I've ever done before. In addition to connecting with others, laughing, dwelling in hope rather than despair, having perspective, allowing yourself to cry, bearing witness, being discerning, there are many other strategies for transcending negative emotions like anger and anxiety. Number one, create a mindfulness practice. I don't care what your belief system is and your religion, it doesn't matter. The loving kindness practice that I've talked about comes from the Buddhist tradition, but it can absolutely be adapted and practiced by anyone, regardless of religious affiliation. Creating a daily loving kindness practice, I'm telling you folks, it can be invaluable. Whether you're dealing with primary trauma stress, like dealing directly with violence or suffering, or secondary trauma stress, like witnessing violence or suffering, or if you're just dealing with what we're all dealing with right now, it is safe to say we're all dealing with secondary trauma stress right now. No matter where you are or what you're dealing with, I can guarantee you that a mindfulness practice will benefit anyone and everyone who wants to deepen their compassion and strengthen their ability to deal with stress, to deal with anxiety, to deal with anger, especially stress that can come from everything we're dealing with right now. If there are particular people you're angry with, if there are particular factions of people you're angry with, I guarantee you that if you committed yourself to something like a loving kindness meditation, and I would encourage you to practice specifically the loving kindness meditation because I think it's really powerful. I just challenge you to give it a try. The basic idea is to extend feelings of warmth and compassion in 3 or 4 phases that are repeated throughout a single sitting period. And you extend these feelings of warmth and compassion. You do it over a variety of, like I said, you do it in 3 or 4 phases. So one phase would be to yourself. One phase would be to people you already know and love. One phase is doing it to people you don't really know who are just kind of neutral in your life. And one is to people who with whom you have a difficult relationship or you have ill feelings towards. And so it's really powerful. There are no rules. You can sit for 15 minutes. You could sit for 50 minutes. But the more you practice, the more you will benefit. And I think it's kind of amazing. And it may be one of the most effective change-making things you do. I'd love to hear back from you if you do try it. Other suggestions, keep a journal, writing about your feelings and your experience. You know, there have been some people who've really suggested, and I think there's something to it, suggesting keeping a COVID journal. It's not too late if you haven't started. I think I talked about that in the 50 Ways to Create a Meaningful Life, is write about what's happening right now. You will want to look back and write about how you're coping with it. You may look back and be really proud. You may look back and realize there are some things you could continue to change. Learn relaxation and breathing techniques. That's going to be something that's really helpful, especially if you're dealing with anger and kind of learning how to cope with anger in the moment, in the heat of the moment. And devise a self-care plan that includes eating well and exercising. The more of a strong foundation we have, the more resilient we will be. when we are struck with what we have been struck with. We don't have to be angry all the time to demonstrate we care. We don't have to be outraged to show that we're conscious. We can develop what Buddhist teacher and Zen priest Joan Halifax calls strong back, soft front. I don't want to say all this right now. I'm just going to say it like that. Anger. And so I'll end with my thoughts. And so anger and outrage are both cultivated. You have to work to keep them alive. If all we focus on is violence, cruelty, injustice, and abuse, we convince ourselves there's nothing else. There is indeed misery and suffering in the world, but that's not all there is. At any given moment, we can choose to focus on one truth or another, and in doing so, form our worldview. We become what we focus on because we are our thoughts. Don't underestimate the power of thought. It shapes our perceptions, it determines our actions, and it creates the world we envision. If we believe that cruelty and injustice will prevail, that's what we will manifest. If we believe that justice and compassion will prevail, then that's what we'll ensure. In any given moment, we can choose despair and anger, or we can choose compassion and hope. I choose hope. And I hope you do too. For the animals, both human and non-human, this is Colleen Patrick-Goudreau. Thanks for listening.